On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. This week, the Democrats gathered in Philadelphia to unify the party, rebuff criticism of Hillary Clinton as untrustworthy, and articulate the dangers that electing Donald Trump would present. Headliners Michelle Obama, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama teed it up for the nominee, and last night, she took what most people this morning are calling a hearty swing. We begin today with Farai Chidea of 538 and Michael Fletcher of ESPN's The Undefeated on Hillary Clinton's launch into the general election. Then, Marilyn Mosby has discontinued the prosecution of officers indicted in the arrest that led to the death of Freddie Gray. Our legal eagles, Edward Smith and David Jaros, help us understand the ramifications moving forward. Gil Sandler has a Baltimore story. Nathan's got the local news. Maryland Morning starts right after these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
I alone can fix it. I will restore law and order to our country. I'm going to make our country rich again.
Americans don't say, I alone can fix it. We say, we'll fix it together.
The Democrats began their week in the city of brotherly love somewhat cantankerously, but by last night, in a deftly orchestrated build-up to Hillary Clinton's historic acceptance speech, the party showed itself to be much more unified than earlier in the week. Hillary Clinton gave a forceful and sometimes funny acceptance speech in which it appeared she was attempting to answer many of the charges leveled against her last week by the Republicans. The difference in tone from the speeches that Donald Trump and Secretary Clinton gave couldn't have been more stark, and recent polls indicate that their race for the White House couldn't be closer. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. There are 101 days until the election on November 8th, and those days will almost certainly be filled with a campaign for president that is destined to be among the nastiest in modern memory. Now that the conventions have come and gone, we'll see if Trump's post-convention bump will last and whether or not Hillary Clinton did anything to convince skeptical voters that she is the better bet. Farai Chidea joins us on the phone from Philadelphia, where she's been covering the convention as a senior writer for 538. Morning, Farai. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm doing fine, and thanks so much for your time. I know you've had a busy week. And here with me in the studio, Michael Fletcher. He's a senior writer with The Undefeated, an online platform that explores the intersection of race, sports, and culture. Morning, Mike. Good to see you.
Oh, good to be here.
So you and Farai actually were together at the Republican convention back in Cleveland last week, and glad to have you both here. So Farai, several people have noted that one of the most interesting and inspiring things about this week is that the oldest daughter of the first black president will be able to vote for the first woman president in 2016.
Yes, absolutely.
You were on the floor last night. I mean, give us a sense of people's understanding of the historic nature of Secretary Clinton's nomination.
Well, I mean, everyone understood it. I will say that, this is my rough guesstimate, that 95% of people were on board, and then there were still a few holdouts, you know, particularly some of the people in the California delegation who just said, you know, not only are we not happy with the nomination, we're still going to boo and protest. I mean, that's one of the reasons that sometimes you heard chants rising from the crowd. It wasn't just to support Secretary Clinton. It was also to drown out some of the remaining dissent. But I think by and large, even most of the people, you know, most of the, say, 5% who hadn't gotten on board, and I spoke with some people who said, well, I used to be Bernie or bust, but, you know, because I respect Senator Sanders, I'm now for Clinton. Most people have gotten firmly on board with Secretary Clinton, and there were tears in the house. A lot of people who could manage to get a ticket brought children as young as toddlers to, you know, show them pictures later, even if they didn't understand why I'm in this room with all these people. Later on, they'll get it.
And Mike Fletcher, I mean, what was your impression of how Mrs. Clinton did? I mean, obviously the stakes were high and people talked about how this was the biggest speech of her life, et cetera, et cetera. How do you think she did?
She looked terrific to me. I watched from home. But she, I think, was very much Hillary Clinton, you know, sort of on message and kind of going point by point. I think it's interesting with her. It feels like a lot of the criticism is like, you know, she doesn't reach this kind of crescendo. She doesn't reach this rhetorical high point. But she was very much, you know, about the details. And I think that's the kind of that's the way she presents herself. And that's who she is as kind of a public figure, someone who, you know, sweats the details, as she put it, and sort of hits point after point after point. And it's so interesting, the contrast with Donald Trump. I was in the room last week, you know, for his speech, and they couldn't be more different.
Yeah. And, you know, Farai, she's got two flanks to deal with. One is the Bernie or bust flank, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, who don't necessarily they may not be as concerned about the trustworthy and honesty issues that other people bring up. They may be more concerned about policy issues, about, you know, stands that they find Mrs. Clinton is too centrist on. But then, of course, you've got a wider audience that does have concerns about Hillary Clinton's trustworthiness and the veracity of what she says. Do you think she did anything to parry those concerns last night?
I think that she really emphasized the strength of her record. I mean, one of the things that struck me is, you know, I've been over the course of my life, and I'm 47, to 27 countries. And I consider that pretty good. She, just as Secretary of State, went to 111 countries, which is more than half of the total countries in the world. And so when you talk about understanding whether it's trade negotiations or diplomatic relations, that goes a long way. I mean, if you've touched foot on someone else's soil, you've talked to their leaders, you've seen inter-ethnic conflict, you've seen what their economy looks like on a granular level, it makes a difference. And so people who don't like her, just on general principles, still won't like her. But I think that she made a persuasive case for anyone who was listening that she actually has done some things that, you know, pretty much, I can't think of another person who's run for president who's visited that much of the world.
And, of course, we had President Obama saying how uniquely qualified he thought Secretary Clinton is, even more qualified than himself or Bill Clinton. Of course, Mike Fletcher, the term Clinton fatigue came into the lexicon in the 1990s. I mean, 20 years we've been dealing with Clinton fatigue. Is that going to be a factor? And in the context of the sort of the energy that the Democrats were able to convey last night and through this week, do you think that remains a factor today?
Oh, I think it's kind of baked into all of these questions surrounding Hillary Clinton. She's been under the microscope for so long. It's been involved in so many issues. And I think, you know, there's this sense that, I think that plays into this, you know, this cloud of, you know, distrust that sort of surrounds her. She's been on the stage a long, long time. She's been involved in a lot of issues. And she's been really, quite honestly, the target of a lot of kind of unfairness and sort of the political, you know, sort of the mud pit of politics, you know, through the years. So I think that has come into play. And on top of that, her experience is kind of lends itself to her, what people will call her incrementalism. You know, she'll talk about solving problems in a way that's probably boring to people. It, you know, she doesn't offer the grand sweeping gesture. You know, she'll say, you know, we have to roll up our sleeves and work on A, B, C, D, and subsections 1, 2, 3, 4. And, you know, that's not exciting to many people, but it's kind of the way government works and the way kind of change happens. So I think all of those, her long experience is her biggest asset and in some ways also the liability that she carries.
Michael Fletcher is a senior writer for The Undefeated, an ESPN platform that explores the intersection between race, sports, and culture. Another ESPN platform is 538, and one of their senior writers, Farai Chidea, joins us on the phone from Philadelphia, where she's been covering the Democratic Convention this week. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking presidential politics. So, Farai, the fact that the Democrats were clearly reaching out to a general election audience last night, they were clearly reaching out to Republicans. I mean, a day or two ago, Michael Bloomberg endorsed Hillary Clinton. Last night, we had an official from the Reagan administration. We had a Marine general saying that she would be a better commander-in-chief than Donald Trump. How does the left wing of the party, the progressive wing, the Sanders contingent react to seeing Secretary Clinton making that broad appeal to the right of the political spectrum?
I think that there will be some members of the Sanders wing of the party who object to the centrist appeal, but I think the greater objection is really to seeing whether or not Clinton will be able to cash the check that she's written with the platform. What I mean by that is that the Democratic Party's platform is historically progressive, and in some ways the Republican Party's platform is historically conservative. And that platform that the Democrats have is really a Sanders-Clinton platform. The ticket may be Clinton-Kaine, but the platform is Sanders-Clinton. So is she going to make that a good check, or is that going to bounce? I mean, she's talking about free community college. It's not free college for everyone, like Senator Sanders wanted, but it's free college for some. There are a lot of things in there that were inspired by Sanders, and the question is whether or not, I think, in the minds of a lot of Sanders people, she will make good on those promises. There were some protests even last night, and this just cracked me up. I've covered a lot of conventions, and I've covered every election since 96, and there were a bunch of Sanders protesters, not of the most intellectual sort, I might say, so not reflective of the whole, basically protesting in a bar on the campus of the complex that housed the Wells Fargo Center. I was like, come on, guys, really? It's like they were protesting essentially for the camera, doing like a march down a one block area with a bar. I think that most Sanders people, first of all, aren't protesting anymore. But secondly, they have legitimate concerns about whether the party has just said a lot of things and whether it's going to do them.
Do you think, Farai, that they see Secretary Clinton's outreach to Republicans, and especially the large number of disaffected Republicans who cannot rally around the current nominee of their party, do you think that they understand that this is strategically perhaps a really good move in terms of how to win the election?
Oddly enough, the outreach to Republicans doesn't mean undermining some of the platforms, because a lot of the people who are crossing over to the Republican Party are working class, Reagan Democrats, union members who really feel economically disadvantaged. And in some ways, that part of the Trump populist coalition has a lot in common economically with the Sanders populist coalition. There's a lot of differences, and there's a lot of racial nastiness that's gone here. But if you look at the economic parts of the Democratic Party platform, those will appeal. And some of the rhetoric from stage last night will appeal. So
sure.
I don't think that the centrist case, aside from, and this is a big aside, trade issues like the TPP, actually undermines the sort of Sanders case.
And Mike Fletcher, before we take a break for the news, do you think people view Hillary Clinton as the heir to the Obama legacy? I mean, she's trying to make that case. And do people perceive it that way?
I'm not so sure that people do quite yet, but I think there's been sort of some movement toward kind of that, that notion.
Okay, well, we got to take a break for the news. Farai Chidea joins us on the phone from Philadelphia. Mike Fletcher with me here in Studio A. We'll have more on politics as soon as we come back after a break. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
There has never been a man or a woman, not me, not Bill, nobody, more qualified than Hillary Clinton to serve as President of the United States of America.
President Barack Obama endorsing Hillary Clinton, his former Secretary of State, at the Democratic Convention this week in Philadelphia. If you're just joining us, it's Maryland Morning. We're talking politics with two of ESPN's finest. Farai Chidea is a senior writer for 538, and she joins us on the phone from Philly. And Michael Fletcher is a senior writer for The Undefeated. So, Farai, you know, the qualifications argument was certainly made very strongly by the president. How is that going to resonate with people who, you know, a large quantity, a large quotient of the voting electorate just does not trust Mr. Trump or Mrs. Clinton? I mean, how do the Democrats counter the argument that she's simply not trustworthy, her great experience aside?
Well, I do think trustworthy and qualified are different, but since you bring it up, there was a Gallup poll in March that said, you know, what would be the worst thing about a Clinton presidency? And the top negative response, 6% of the total, was that she's not qualified, which I think is on its face just ridiculous. But I think there's a lot of sexism embedded in that. But then you got to other explanations. One was, I don't want Bill Clinton back in the White House. You know, there were many different things. But I do think that the qualifications issue comes up as a kind of code for gender, in the same way that we've seen so much racial code during the Obama years. You know, many different things. Like, who thought professorial could be an insult? But it was somehow used to say, he's not like us. You know, and I think it had some racial implications in a really weird, backhanded way. It's like, well, if you don't want to say that he's the N-word and you don't want to even say that he's, you know, too black, well, maybe you say he's too smart. It's like, when has being too smart been a bad thing? So people, you know, people kind of come up with different codes for what they want. But I think the trustworthy issue breaks down to two things. One is that she's been in the public eye so long. Second is issues like Benghazi, which are still in the news. And third is the coded sexism. So depending on where you're coming from with the trustworthy issue, someone like President Obama making an appeal will affect how you think, or it won't. If you're someone who just de facto thinks a woman shouldn't be president, which was also one of the reasons some people gave in that poll, 4% of people just don't want a female president, you're not going to be persuadable no matter what.
Yeah, and Mike Fletcher, it was the competence and experience argument that the not only Michelle Obama made and Bill Clinton made and the president made, but they were making sort of in this arc, this build-up to Mrs. Clinton's address last night. Here's the father of a Muslim army soldier who was killed in the war in Afghanistan. This is Khazir Khan.
Donald Trump, you're asking Americans to trust you with their future. Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
So, Mike, embracing the Constitution is something that, you know, typically that's a Republican argument, and they're making it in a very, I thought, a very creative way, in that, you know, here's a man of Muslim heritage, you know, who obviously, you know, Trump has had some pretty nasty things to say about Muslims during this campaign. How do you think that argument's going to fly?
I think it's one of the stronger arguments Hillary Clinton has going forward, and I think last night a lot of it, in addition to sort of soften the image of Hillary Clinton, if you will, was to sort of remind people sort of how sort of unusual, outrageous in many cases, the argument Donald Trump has made is. I mean, some of the policy statements he's made, some of the things he wants to do, he promises to do as president, are, you know, basically outrageous in the eyes of many. And Hillary Clinton, I think, wanted to remind voters of that fact. Like, whatever you think of her, however trustworthy or not you think she is, you know, look at this guy who's the Republican nominee. He's unlike any major party nominee we've seen, certainly in my lifetime.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Farai Chidea joins me on the phone from Philadelphia, where she's been covering the Democratic Convention for 538, one of ESPN's platforms. Another ESPN platform is The Undefeated. Mike Fletcher is here in the studio. He's a senior writer with that particular platform, exploring the intersection of race, culture, and politics. Farai, how about the role of Bill Clinton? He gave what a lot of folks thought was a very persuasive speech the other night. On the other hand, if Secretary Clinton does have trustworthy and honesty issues with a wide electorate. Many of them, you know, are generated because of their understanding or their recollection of Bill Clinton. Is he going to be an asset or a liability?
I think both. You know, there's no question about it. Where, for example, the children of both candidates, Ivanka and Chelsea, are seen as unqualified wins for the campaign. I think Bill Clinton is at this point, for different voters, probably, you know, 60 to 75% win and then a loss for other people. It really depends on your political persuasion and what you think of the Clinton legacy, what you think of the impeachment. You know, even though he was, you know, not pushed out of office, that sucked up a lot of airtime in American life. And you know, paradoxically at this point, some people now think that, you know, he was persecuted. I mean, perhaps not paradoxically, but what I'm saying is that's definitely a glass half full, glass half empty issue. You know, how you look at the Clinton legacy in terms of his personal brand depends on whether you're looking at the work of the Clinton Foundation, et cetera, or whether you look at him as someone who had an indiscretion in the Oval Office. And different people are going to look at it different ways. But I think by and large, you know, what I was struck by was that even though Bill Clinton had a prominent speaking role, this is Hillary Clinton's election. And Bill Clinton is not even her most important surrogate. That's President Obama. And he's made it clear that he's going to be out there on the stump for her. And I think he's far more important to this election than her husband.
One of the things that did not in any way resemble the Republican convention, although there were some things in the Democratic convention that at least resembled Republican conventions of old, was the prominence of the mothers of the movement. Here's what a few of these mothers had to say at the convention this week in Philadelphia.
Hillary Clinton isn't afraid to say that Black Lives Matter. She isn't afraid to sit at a table with grieving mothers and bear the full force of our anguish. She doesn't build walls around her heart. Not only did she listen to our problems, she invited us to become a part of the solution.
So Mike Fletcher, you know, Farai touched on the intermingling of race and gender and the sort of the unspoken code that we heard some terms bandied about. What do you think the role of Black Lives Matter is going to be in this campaign moving forward?
I think that's going to be one of the, you know, points of departure for the two campaigns. Like one phrase you heard repeatedly in Cleveland was law and order, law and order. You know, Mr. Trump said, I'll be the law and order president, as if there was some sort of, you know, sort of tension between that and Black Lives Matter. You know, but I think in the minds of a lot of American voters, there may well be. And I think that's something that Mr. Trump's going to try to exploit. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I'm imagining a debate one day where, you know, Trump says all lives matter. And, you know, something like that, I think will be a tension point.
Is the only way, Mike, that Donald Trump can, you know, make some gains on that issue, is the only way he can do that is by being divisive? In other words, is he going to have to be racially divisive in order to pick up votes around that particular notion?
I don't know that he has to be, but I think he's shown every indication that he's willing to go down that path, and he would never describe it as being racially divisive, of course. He would say, oh, look, you know, African-American community suffered the most violence, this, that, and the other. And if we don't say support our police 100%, we're working against that goal. And he may argue that Black Lives Matter sort of muddles that message. So I think he'd be divisive in ways that maybe he doesn't even understand.
And for Aicha Dutt,
he also chose as one of his convention speakers a very conservative Black sheriff who made the point Blue Lives Matter. And I think that the Democratic convention was very strategic in that they had, you know, the mothers of people slain by police, but they also had the wives and relatives of people who were slain police officers saying, look, we're not picking a side, we just don't want people to die. But if you're someone who is not receptive to hearing a message about Black Lives Matter, that's still not going to be enough for you. So I think both sides will just stick, they'll stay in their lane.
Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton also made an appeal to working class families. And oftentimes when folks use the term working class families, they're thinking about that white working class in the Rust Belt, the place, the demographic that Mr. Trump is reputedly got to have in order to win this election. Here's a little bit about what she had to say about that last night.
I've gone around the country talking to working families, and I've heard from many who feel like the economy sure isn't working for them. Some of you are frustrated, even furious. And you know what? You're right. It's not yet working the way it should. My primary mission as president will be to create more opportunity and more good jobs with rising wages right here in the United States.
So for I Today, Adam Gopnik in The New Yorker made an interesting point, I thought, a week or two ago, in which he talked about Trump embracing this populist appeal, saying that Trump did not come to political attention as a populist. He came to political attention as a racist, as a proponent of birtherism. This is what put him on the national stage. How effective do you think it's going to be for Trump, and how possible do you think it's going to be for Trump to sustain this populist notion between now and November for the next 101 days?
I think it's very possible. I mean, I think that, again, there's the dog whistle and there's what gets said plainly. And the thing that really has typified the Trump run is that he's much more willing to just say racist stuff as opposed to using what's called dog whistle politics, which is that you make little veiled comments, you know. And so he's had some public issues with anti-Semitism, certainly racism, Islamophobia. But, you know, with it comes a form of muddled economic populism. But I write sometimes about the far right in Europe, and that's often the case, too. If you look at the National Front, the National Front actually has both a more extreme platform and a more coherent platform. But the National Front in France, which is the far right party there, is economic populism, and we hate immigrants, and we hate people of color. And those two things have become kind of the chocolate and peanut butter of far-right populism.
Mike Fletcher, what about third-party candidates? Jill Stein of the Green Party, Gary Johnson, the Libertarian, who's running with Bill Weld, who's the former governor of Massachusetts. Folks have said that, you know, if ever there were a time that were ripe for a third-party candidate, it's this year, because both of the major party candidates have such high unfavorability ratings. What sort of chance you give them?
Well, I think if particularly Mr. Johnson can poll well enough to qualify for debates, that can be a game changer, because once I think the broader American public sees someone like that on stage, and if you're not a big fan of Hillary Clinton for whatever reason, and you don't like Donald Trump, you know, this third party may be appealing. You could have like a kind of a Ross Perot, you know, thing going on in this country. And what's unclear to me is sort of
Perot, his highest electoral return was about 19%.
Yeah, something like, which was very significant.
Well, that was the popular vote. He got no electoral vote.
Exactly.
Right.
So he may have changed the outcome in some states. I'm not clear on that. But, you know, it's actually people like George Wallace who got electoral votes as third-party candidates because they were segregationist and they did well in the South and got a regional total that allowed them to win some electoral votes. But if you win a little bit everywhere, that gets you nothing on the big board.
Right. And also, it's unclear to me what, you know, sort of who loses, you know, if there's a third party candidate that does well. It's unclear to me whether it's, you know, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump that, you know,
yeah, and is that unclear? I mean, because there's a lot of Bernie Sanders folks threatening to vote Green Party, and you know, there are some Republicans who, you know, they are the Never Trumpers are certainly as vocal, if not more vocal, than the Bernie or Bust coalition. I mean, it is a toss up as to who it helps more. Clearly, with Ross Perot, it helped Bill Clinton.
Right, exactly. Right.
Yeah, I think honestly that Johnson is the strongest third party candidate, and it will help Clinton more in his case. And of course, the Green Party will hurt Clinton, but I think they're not as strong as the Johnson run.
Here's Michelle Obama speaking on Monday night.
I wake up every morning in a house
that was built by slaves. And I watch my daughters, two beautiful, intelligent black young women, playing with their dogs on the White House lawn. And because of Hillary Clinton, my daughters and all our sons and daughters now take for granted that a woman can be president of the United States.
Mike Fletcher, we got to call it quits this morning, but will the African-American community come out and support Hillary Clinton the way they supported Barack Obama?
Well, I don't know if be quiet is overwhelming, but I think with Obama's sort of role as the number one surrogate, I think that's a real possibility.
And for I Today, what do you think?
I think it depends on the ground organizing, and I'm not sure it's as strong this time around.
Farai Chideh has joined us on the phone from Philadelphia, where she's been covering the Democratic Convention as a senior writer for 538. That's ESPN's site for polling and analysis on politics, economics, culture, and other topics. Her latest book is called The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. Michael Fletcher is with me here in the studio, a senior writer for The Undefeated on ESPN's platform. His latest book is Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. Thanks to you both. Appreciate it. And we'll talk to you again as the campaign continues. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. More coming up after a break for the news. First, here's a Baltimore story with Gil Sandler.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Thank you, Mr. Sterner. Much appreciated. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Now, a conversation with our legal experts, Edward Smith and David Jaros, about the announcement on Wednesday by State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby that she was abandoning her plans to prosecute the officers who remained to be tried or retried in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. So to recap briefly, last December, Officer William Porter's trial ended with a hung jury. Over the next several months, Edward Nero, Caesar Goodson, and Brian Rice were acquitted by Judge Barry Williams in bench trials. On Wednesday, State's Attorney Mosby announced that she will not pursue prosecutions of Officer Garrett Miller and Sergeant Alicia White, and that she will not retry Officer Porter. Edward Smith is an attorney in private practice. He served in the office of the state's attorney, and he's argued cases in front of the Supreme Court. He joins us from a courthouse in Baltimore County, where he is arguing a case this morning. Good morning, Ed. Nice to talk to you.
Hey, good to talk to you, Tom.
And David Jaros is an associate professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. So, Dave, let me turn to you first. The press conference that State's Attorney Mosby had in front of the Gilmore Homes on Wednesday when she made this announcement that she was going to dismiss the cases against the remaining officers was really extraordinary in a lot of ways. I mean, at one point, she talked about the inherent bias that's in place when police investigate themselves. That's an extraordinary statement for a state's attorney that works closely with the police, isn't it?
It really was. And the level of animosity between at least the high level of this office and the police is really unusual and astounding. This is a case that has raised, you know, deep questions. But I think also if we pull back a little bit, Ms. Mosby's argument sort of points to, I think, one big takeaway from all of this, which is both sides feel very strongly that there were unfair motivations of the other side. And I think it points to how both in investigation and prosecution of these kinds of cases involving the police, we may need a neutral third party to step in and both investigate and ultimately prosecute these cases.
Yeah, that's interesting. Ed Smith, what do you think, and now that, you know, the dust is beginning to settle from this very long process leading from the violence that the city experienced in late April, the indictments that State's Attorney Mosby announced on the 1st of May, and then, you know, through this week when the remaining charges end up being dismissed. Ultimately, what have we learned?
Well, Tom, I think what we have learned is that we can get through anything if we have the faith and the commitment and the principles to wade through it. I see this as a lose-lose and a win-win situation for both the police and for the state's attorney's office. If they look towards the future, and I don't see any really vitriolic problems with the police department, at least not the commissioner, who sets the tone of what the police department does. I see some lawyers who want to take down this the state's attorney, and I see some people in the community who are disappointed. But you get over your disappointments, you forge ahead, and you make something out of this very bad situation. A man is dead. We have to understand that. We have to understand the lessons from what happened as a result of really problems on both sides with this case. But we have to move on.
And Dave Jaros, we not only heard from Marilyn Mosby on Wednesday, we've heard this week as well from the attorneys who represented some of the officers, as well as the prosecutorial team, Janice Bledsoe and Michael Schatzow. The defense attorney said that Marilyn Mosby could have requested help from a whole bunch of different agencies and did not. They really questioned the sort of efficacy and sincerity, if you will, of Marilyn Mosby's investigation before she brought these charges. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, I think I'm not in a position to know. There's a lot of allegations on both sides about misconduct or failures to do their job, and I can't say. I think, you know, yesterday there was also a press conference where the two state's attorneys who tried the case talked about their process. And Assistant State's Attorney Schatzow pointed out that there was not a steady climb of information discovered during the course of the investigation. It's not as if there was a whole lot more to learn. To some extent, we have to recognize it's hard to investigate cases involving police misconduct and police brutality. There is, and I think we have to acknowledge.
It's just inherently difficult.
It's very hard. And there is social pressure among police officers not to help in the investigation of a fellow brother or sister officer. So there were real challenges here. I think, as Ed points out, the question really is going to be, what kind of reforms do we institute going forward?
And Ed, what's your take on that? You've defended officers when they go to their review boards, the trial reviews. Do you think that this experience will dramatically change, you know, procedurally and culturally, the way that the Baltimore City Police Department operates?
Oh, I definitely do. I think it will be an example for the rest of the nation as to what happens in Baltimore City. I believe in police officers. When my brother has been a police officer for 35 years, I believe in the state's attorney's office. They are the line that protects us in this city. The takeaway has to be we can be better. All of us can be better as long as we have good faith, as long as we have morality, and as long as we look to be better. People who are trying to tear us down by making wild statements and accusations, they need to be ignored, and we need to push forward.
And Dave Jaros, the officers that still face internal reviews, what's going to be different between those endeavors and the criminal trials? I mean, is the evidence the same? Are the arguments the same, or do they differ considerably?
Well, one fundamental difference is the burden of proof. And we have to remember that this is a hard case to prove, and proving a crime required every element be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, there's a much different level of finding. They have to find only by preponderance of the evidence, which means a little more than 50%. And the question is just whether or not they're doing their job or they can be fired. So it's a much lower standard. But I think people should watch this process carefully, because what I think many people don't recognize, that a lot of the questions about how the police are ultimately regulated come down to difficult questions of what's in that contract between the city and the police. And those are things that the public doesn't usually pay attention to.
Indeed. Dave Jaros from the University of Baltimore and Ed Smith, a private attorney in private practice. I appreciate both of you guys joining us this morning and all the mornings that you've shed light on this. Thanks so much to both of you.
Tom, appreciate you. Dave, you take care of yourself. And to the listeners, it's been fun.
Okay. Attorney Edward Smith, he has served as both a prosecutor and a defense lawyer. David Jaros is on the faculty of the University of Baltimore School of Law. They've been helping us unpack the vagaries of the cases of the officers involved in the arrest that led to the death of Freddie Gray. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, a special edition of Maryland Morning. We'll get to spend the hour with Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake. We'll get her reaction to Marilyn Mosby's announcement, her take on the status of the Port Covington TIF, her position on the proposal to raise the minimum wage in Baltimore, and a host of other issues. I hope you can join us Monday morning for Maryland Morning with the Mayor. Maryland Morning's director, engineer, and co-host is Nathan Sterner. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill, with production assistance from Lauren Ferguson. And Shane Raphael has been our intern this summer, and we wish him all the best as he moves on with his education. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Maryland Morning theme music. Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. You can check them out online, ZEKESCoffee.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Really appreciate it. Garrison Keillor is up next with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great weekend.